Welcome to the Hyper Guy Motivational Podcast. Thank you so much for being with me today. I have an amazing guest today. He's about, I would say, probably about 3 months in the making. His name is Dr. Apollo Ameka. Thank you so much for being here today, Apollo.
Oh, it's my extreme pleasure.
And I love having my fellow Trojans on, especially I'm trying to be a doctor like you, Apollo. I'm trying to catch up with you. But
you're almost there.
I want to extol, I'm going to go ahead and extol your virtues first. Apollo, you are a strategy and leadership consultant, and you've worked with Fortune 500 companies, and you've actually helped build some of these companies. You're a former Green Beret, Special Forces, for about 12 years, managing director of Apollo Strategy Group. You're a former intelligence analyst for the FBI. I always have to put this in, you're a father of two. That's probably one of your most important jobs, correct?
I love it.
Yeah, you have a BA in sociology from USC. You graduated with honors, and you all and you have your doctorate in education in policy planning and development. Did I miss anything?
You didn't. It's actually it's out of the policy school. The doctorate is a doctorate of policy planning and development. Yeah.
Oh, that's so are you out of Price?
Yeah, exactly.
No way. That's amazing. Oh, that's amazing. I love it. I have a master's from Price, so. I actually love the Soul Price School. So it's one of my favorite schools.
Yeah, we met at the School of Education event, but yeah, I was a crossover from Price.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you have a very interesting and a really amazing story. And when I heard your story and I was doing some research on you, you're quite a success story in a lot of ways. And What was it like growing up for you? What did you grow up, first of all?
Oh man, I just turned 40 last month, and I think it's caused me to reflect a ton. So I was kind of knew my story was unique, even a little bit while it was happening. But now I'm just like, I look back, and again, like you said, raising kids of my own now, I'm like, oh my gosh, how did that work? How did that, you know, how am I where I am? So my background, I grew up in the Northwest primarily, in and around Seattle. Grew up pretty broke. And I was the youngest of four boys, and I was the youngest by a lot. So my parents, who got married, my mom was white and my dad is black, and they got married in the 60s before anti-miscegenation laws were passed. So it was still illegal in a bunch of states for them to be married. And they kind of, I think it's kind of a defining characteristic of their lives in a lot of ways. And so I don't know that they were traditional kind of hippies, but they were hippie-ish, hippie adjacent, if you will. There was a lot of kind of nonconformity in my household growing up. My next oldest brother is 11 years older than I am. And so my brothers were 11, 13, and 15 when I was born. And it's funny because people are always saying, oh, Apollo, like Apollo, the Greek god, or Apollo 13. But, my teenage brothers loved Apollo Creed. When I was born, that's how I was named. And that's kind of like, yeah, my parents were like, yeah, okay, whatever, sure. Yeah, why not? And that's kind of how my whole upbringing was yeah, okay, sure, whatever. Yeah, why not? So I didn't go to much school beyond fourth grade, because one day I came home and I was just like, I hate school. And my mom was like, oh, we're thinking of homeschooling you. And I said, oh, for fifth grade, I could just not go back to school. And she said, you don't have to go back tomorrow. And my mind was blown. And so, yeah, that's it. I mean, like, I finished out the week, and then like Monday rolled around and I didn't go back to school, and they couldn't get me to do schoolwork either. So I didn't do a lot of schoolwork. And then fifth grade, summer came and my friends got out of school and I was so happy to see them. And then I was like, I need to go back to school socially, educationally, and all, like, I just need to go back. And so I went back to fifth grade, And I was there for 5 weeks. And I remember being like, oh my gosh, this is terrible. And I remember the inner conflict and being like, well, but no, I said I was going to come back here and for all these reasons. And so I went and told my mom. I was like, Mom, I remember why I didn't want to be here. This sucks. And she's like, oh, well, just don't go. And so that's basically my whole, you know, fourth grade through 12th grade until I finally dropped out. It was a little bit of in and out of school, all the way, you know, up to the point that I dropped out.
So Apollo, what were you doing that whole time? I mean, did you know what you wanted to do? How would you occupy your days? And did you have an idea of what you wanted to do at some point in your life, or how did you manage all that? And how did your parents manage all that?
Yeah. So I think I wanted to know, I mean, I knew what I wanted to do from the time that I was 13. And so, I mean, I was like, my third parent was a TV, and I loved TV. I loved video games. So I spent a lot of time watching TV. You know, my mom was a substitute teacher, so she would work occasionally. But I mean, literally I'd be watching soap operas in the middle of the day with her, watching Oprah in the middle of the day with her. And so I watched a good amount of TV, but I grew up in this kind of rural environment, and, I would, you know, ride bikes and build tree houses and all this stuff, a lot of this stuff by myself. Until I was 11, my brother came back from college. He graduated and came back from college, and he kind of took me under his wing and took me to Seattle. So I grew up in this really predominantly white environment until I was around 11. And then I started hanging out with my brother, who, when he graduated from college, was doing these theater programs in Seattle, with kids from the projects in Seattle. And so I went from being in this super, you know, predominantly white environment where I was like the black kid in class, and we were like one of four black families in our town and super recognizable, to being like, you know, with all these kids who were growing up in the projects. And so I would do a lot of theater programs and just kind of hang with my brother. Getting back to the TV piece, I watched a lot of Saturday Night Live and Mad TV, and X-Files. And so my dreams were either to be in the FBI because of the X-Files, or to be on Saturday Night Live because I love Saturday Night Live.
So then what made you, when you turned 18, did you have your high school diploma? How did that work out? And then how did you end up, what did you end up doing at the age of 18? Did you leave home? What was that transition like for you?
Yeah, so actually I was 17. And again, I had been kind of bouncing in and out of school. I was doing some community college stuff. And then my mom got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer when I had just turned 17. And, you know, I don't know if you know anything about pancreatic cancer, but it's super hard to detect. And it's really it's not a good prognosis for most folks, especially back then. And so she died 5 months after she was diagnosed. And I was not a strong student up to that point. I didn't have really solid habits. The same thing with school, in terms of stepping away from school. I would step away from basketball, like in the middle of the season, baseball, soccer, everything that I tried, I basically would get tired of it. And my parents would just be like, yeah, okay, well, just stop. If you don't want to go, don't go. And so when she died, I was really like in a tailspin, and didn't have kind of, again, like habits and routines and skills to lean back on, to fall back on. So I was like, oh, I need to put myself in an environment where I'm going to get some skills. I'm not going to be able to get to the FBI or Saturday Night Live or whatever, with these habits and these skills and, you know, being a high school dropout. So at 17, my dad signed for me to be able to join the military. And at 17, that's what I did. I went into the military as an intelligence analyst because the recruiter told me that that would help me get into the FBI.
So what was that like? What branch of the military did you join then? Can you tell me what that process was like for you when you how was it going to boot camp, and how did you make it through that boot camp? Was that a difficult process for you? Because you went from a lot of unstructure to very structured.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, so I was 17, and I remember that I had to get my GED in order to be able to get into the military. And so that was probably the most anxiety inducing part of the process, was, am I going to be able to pass the GED? And I did well enough. I think I did well, if I remember, and I did definitely well enough to get into the military at the time. I remember my mom talking about the National Guard, and she thought the National Guard was really noble, because it's like, oh, you're a citizen soldier, and if something is, you know, if something's popping off in your your homeland, then you rise to the occasion, whether it's a flood or a fire or whatever. And so she thought that that was really noble. And so I was like, okay, I think she'd be cool with this. And this was right after 9/11 happened, but I was like, man, we got presidents that joined the National Guard to avoid war. So like, I'm not going to war. I'm going to be like, you know, dangling from a helicopter, rescuing somebody off of a rooftop who's, you know, in a flood or whatever. And so I was like, okay, yeah, National Guard, that sounds good. And then I got in, you know, I passed the GED, went to boot camp. And I remember a drill sergeant saying, oh, who, raise your hand if you in the National Guard or the reserve. And, you know, raise my hand and like, y'all think y'all not going to war? Y'all think y'all not going? Oh, we all going. I'll see you over there. We all going. And I was like, man, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And then like, you know, 16 months later, I was in Iraq. So yeah, like, yeah, we all went. So that was my first time overseas. Was back, like, you know, pretty shortly after I got in.
And what was that experience like for you in Iraq? I assume when you first went over, did you go in as an intelligence officer? And then later on, how did you transition to the Green Berets?
Yeah. So that, I mean, it was life altering. Going over was life altering. And I did go over as intel, and specifically as a strategic intelligence analyst. And so, you know, the perspective that that gives you is just, it's really wild. I guess actually to step back a second, going through basic training was kind of like, it was honestly kind of refreshing, because I just didn't have any discipline or habits, like good habits growing up. And so, and I shouldn't say any, I mean, there was a lot of stuff that I knew how to do that my peers couldn't do, like navigate public transportation at the time that I was 8, you know, talk to adults, you know, like engage with customer service. There were a lot of things, critical thinking. There was a lot of stuff that a lot of skills that I had, but they were not the kind of skills that the world is looking for a 17-year-old kid to have. You know, the things that people would expect from you, that you, you know, show up at the right time in the right place, and you, you know, again, have that kind of pedigree of, okay, you graduated from high school and you're going to college or a trade school or a job or whatever. I just didn't have any of that. And the first academic program that I ever graduated from was military intelligence school. And part of the creed of an intelligence analyst is to find, know, and never lose the enemy. So, you know, I know that your doctoral work has to do with empathy in policing. And a lot of what I learned is empathizing with the enemy, because we have to, in a kind of very non-judgmental way, understand enemy forces and kind of hostile actions and intentions. And that was, and I learned how to do that in an academic kind of way, a very structured kind of way, so that I could play the role of the enemy when we would go into planning, you know, and you're in operations planning and you're literally sitting across the table from the folks who are planning operations, and you're playing the role of the enemy. And so it was really interesting being deployed and having that role of playing the role of the enemy in a counterinsurgency fight where it's a 360-degree battlefield, and the enemy is not an organized nation state military force, but it's a, you know, the enemy is aligned by a vision, by a cause, by a set of beliefs, and was integrated into the population, you know. And so it was very, very wild applying what I learned academically as an intelligence analyst to this 360-degree battlefield, and trying to empathize with folks who were trying to kill me and my buddies, you know. And that's so that was like my first job, really. I was a camp counselor actually when I was 16 at an arts camp, but my first real job was, you know, trying to understand and empathize with folks who were trying to do me and my buddies harm. And so, you know, it was just a really wild, it was a really, really wild experience for a teenager. And I was able to do some really cool work. And I think some kind of, you know, a lot of life-saving stuff I'm really proud of the work, although, you know, obviously the Iraq War doesn't have a great legacy. I'm proud of the work that I was able to do over there, and the small impact that I was able to make from the position that I was in. But it made me also realize that as a junior enlisted person in the military with a GED, I had so little power. You know, the things that I was able to do over there were because of those skills that I talked about before, of critical thinking, understanding how to build relationships with people. But, you know, the people who were making all the decisions were the folks who had all the habits and all of the credentials and all of the pedigree that I didn't have. And so it was there in Iraq that I said, you know what, I need to get a doctorate. I need to get a terminal degree so that way I'll never be kept out of a room or silenced because I don't have the credentials or the paper. So, you know, that was a little bit misguided at the time. It's, you know, credibility comes down to more than credentials, but that was a big seed that was planted that I planted in myself, I guess, at that time.
And what was going through the Green Beret recruiting process and what was the training process? I know it's very arduous. Was there, when you were going through there, did you ever doubt yourself? I know that some of the other people that I've had on the show before, and you look like you're in great shape, but you're not looking like a bodybuilder. I think a lot of times we think, when we think of Navy SEALs and we think of those, we're thinking like they're just absolutely like these, look like Conan the Barbarian. What was that like getting through that? What was the process like getting through the Green Beret training? Did you ever doubt yourself? Did you ever think, hey, you know, I can't do this? And how did you get through it?
I didn't doubt myself until right now in this very moment, man, where you just said that I'm not big enough. So actually, I got to go hit the gym. I got to go hit the weights. And see, they can't hear right now because you're muted. But trust me, people, he is laughing his ass off. Okay. So, I mean, the Green Beret process was really, it was arduous at times. I think, well, the way that I got there is, so I ended up coming off of active duty that time in Iraq, and I actually threw a conversation with my brother who had just gotten a job as a professor at USC. I was like, hey man, you should move to LA, go to community college and try to transfer to USC. And he's like, you can pursue the FBI and Saturday Night Live from LA. And I had never been to LA. I'd been to Disneyland once when my brother took me when I was 13, but that's not LA. And so I just took him up on it, came off of active duty and moved straight to LA, went to community college, transferred to SC. And then, I got this internship at the FBI after my senior year. And the whole time I was still in the National Guard. So basically on reserve status, got this internship at the FBI and ended up, you know, converting that into a full-time position. So when I graduated from the FBI Academy, I was kind of like, what am I going to do? You know, I came back to LA and I was working out of the LA field office and I was like, what am I going to do with this military career? Should I get out? You know, I don't really want to become a commissioned officer. You know I want to go to grad school. What am I going to do with this thing? And I went to this training, and I sat in between two guys who were intel dudes who had supported special forces units, who had supported Green Berets. And I told them like, oh yeah, I used to want to really try out for that. And they're like, oh, well, why didn't you? And I was like, well, I wanted to get kind of my civilian life straightened out. I wanted to get my degree. And they're like, well, you have your degree now, right? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, why don't you try out? And I was like, Yeah, I'm gonna do that. So then I called around and I figured out how to try out. And so the what was it called? Oh, Safari, Special Forces Readiness Evaluation, I think is what it's called. So like this, you know, unit in California you do the Safari with, and it's you have to do a PT test. I mean, it varies, it changes all the time, but when I went through it was a PT test, a ruck march, pull-ups, swim, I don't know, it was a bunch of different activities. And I had always been pretty athletic, but I had never been competitively athletic. And I knew that probably the kind of most challenging thing was rucking. I'd never had any experience like putting a heavy pack on my back and, you know, having to move quickly for a long time over a long distance. So I was in the FBI. I lived 8 miles from work. I lived 8 miles from the field office. I just grabbed like, and I knew that the training weight, you know, it's 45 pounds dry, but you have to add water, right? And so I was like, okay, what's that? That's like 60 pounds. So I went and I bought like a 60 pound bag of concrete and just tossed it in like this regular cloth backpack with no frame. I had my buddy pick me up. He lived near me, pick me up from my house. And I was like, okay, I'm going to ruck back from work. And I'm going to ruck back from work. And this is going to like be my test. It was 8 miles. This is going to be my test to see like, am I going to be able to do this? Am I going to be able to train up to this? And so literally like 5 miles into my ruck back home from work there, like my back was breaking. I had this, what was a 60 pound bag of concrete plus my clothes in the backpack. And like my back was breaking, and like at like 4 or 5 miles, there were like tears streaming down my face. I contemplated calling my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, and being like, come get me. I'm not gonna make it. And so then I get home. I walked all the way home and I get there and I'm just like, my back is broken. My spirit is broken. I'm like exhausted and I'm like, I am not cut out for this. So I was telling a buddy about it and he was like, wait, you did that with like a regular backpack? Dude, you need a ruck. You need a frame. And so like he dropped his ruck off and I tried it again. And I was like, oh my God, this is so much more manageable. But one of the things that I think is defining in my preparation, and it's kind of how I've approached life in general now, is I'm like, okay, well, if I have to train with 45, 60 pounds, whatever, I want to overtrain. Because I know how important rucking is. Like for the selection process, the actual selection process for Green Berets, which is 3 weeks long, you pretty much have a ruck on the whole time. And so I was like, okay, I know that I have to be good at that. So I was like, all right, I'm gonna train at, you know, 70 pounds instead of 60. And instead of hitting 15-minute miles, I'm gonna aim for 12-minute miles. And so I had my 60-pound bag of concrete and all this stuff. And so I started where I would ruck to and from work 8 miles, you know, 2 to 4 times a week. And I got really fast. And then I finally measured my ruck and it weighed like 104 pounds. And so I actually was super overtrained. So then when I went to selection, I just crushed it. Out of like 600 dudes, I think I came in like 12th on the ruck or something like that. So you go through the whole selection process. That was a little, nerve-wracking. That 3 week selection process, I did a bunch of stuff that I've never done before, like land navigation, where they just, you know, you start at night and you're by yourself. You can't use flashlights. You have to avoid roads. And then you have like 10 hours to find a bunch of points just using a, you know, a compass while, again, you've got 60 or 70 pounds on your back, traipsing through the North Carolina wilderness. And so, you know, being alone at night and hearing stuff go bump in the night and not knowing where you are and, you know, falling and getting cut up by sticker bushes and having to wade through rivers and all of that stuff was, it was defining stuff. But I think, I also I wanted to be on Saturday Night Live. So there was a couple times at selection where my mouth, got me into some trouble, joking around at the wrong time. But I think, you know, the times when I doubted myself the most was probably when I got into the, when I got selected. You know, I went through this 3-week selection, got selected, and then you go to airborne school and you're jumping out of planes. All that was like pretty chill too. And then you have to, going to the Special Forces qualification course, you are required to learn a language. You're required to have a technical specialty. You're required to pass the small unit tactics, which is like a little mini ranger school, where you're, you know, just conducting raids, recons, ambushes over and over and over again. And then you have to kind of be able to pull all of that stuff together and be a member of a team and integrate your technical proficiency, which mine was communications, with the tactical stuff, with the team building stuff, with the everything. And the hardest part for me was small unit tactics. That was the hardest part, not physically and not even like content wise, but just not knowing if I was going to have to do it again. Cause it was like 8 or 10 weeks long. And if you didn't pass, you wouldn't know if you passed until the end. And if you didn't pass, you either got to like, hey, never be like, you can't come back. We don't want you and you can't come back. Or, hey, we're going to give you another chance to do this of 8 or 10 weeks. And so that not knowing, was probably the most difficult time for me of understanding, am I going to make it or not? And ultimately I passed it just fine. But that was probably mentally the hardest part.
Yeah. And I think that's the point I always try to get to. I think I see people like yourself that are in great physical shape, but it's the mental side that I'm always impressed by. It's that mental fortitude. So there's the physical body part, but it's just the mental fortitude to be able to get past those barriers that stop a lot of people. Yeah. So can you tell me, what do you think that you possess, or what do you think is that you need to work on, or people need to work on, in order to get through those difficult times? What do you suggest for people to get through those kind of difficult times and push through those?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that there are, I think it's about finding the right blend of like actual physical preparation and then the mental preparation. Because I saw a lot of guys who had, you know, way more tactical experience than me, way more deployment experience, dudes who were kind of like more fit than me, who didn't make it. You know, I think probably the attrition rate was somewhere between 85% and 95% of like from the beginning of the pipeline all the way through, for my specific teams. And then, so like watching these people who seemed kind of legendary to me, and then it's like, oh, but they failed something, or they had some disciplinary issue, or they had some whatever. It was really wild. So I think that's part of the thing that's really challenging in life is like, well, how much of this is mental and how much of it is about how I'm actually prepared in the real world? And for me, again, it was like, well, okay, I know that I'm going to have to be doing a bunch of stuff that I've never done before, right? And I know I'm going to be engaging with other personalities, people who differ from me in terms of how they look at the world, you know, whether it's politically, philosophically, their backgrounds and upbringings. And so that's tough enough if you're at like a cocktail party, right? Like going someplace with people with differing views and being there for like 2 hours and making it out the other side, you know, with more friends than you walked in is tough. So you do, you add that, you know, you add the issue of having, you know, carrying a bunch of weight on your back, of not having slept, of not having eaten, and the personality dynamics just become all the more challenging. And so I said, you know, I'm just going to make the ruck a non-issue. I'm going to make the ruck. And so that's what I continued to train with incredibly heavy weight because, yeah, okay, like there's a mental component to rucking, but then there's also a, like, there's just a physical, are you physically prepared to do this? And my goal is, you know, I think a lot of people don't really kind of, they don't really respect their willpower. And by that, I mean, they're just like, I'm going to let like Apollo tomorrow, I'm going to let tomorrow Apollo figure that out. And like Apollo tomorrow will just have to muscle through it, you know, and is going to have to live with the my consequences, you know, the consequences of my actions or inactions. And for me, I'm like, I'm trying to set Apollo tomorrow up for success. So that way Apollo tomorrow doesn't have to dig deep, doesn't have to like find the will to muscle through a thing, because like I prepared today so that I don't have to use any willpower tomorrow. Right. So, but I think that knowing what to prepare for and in what ways to prepare, and, you know, that's where people get messed up, because they either don't prepare at all, or they try to be perfectionists and they try to be 100%, 110% prepared on 100% of the things they have to do. And so, yeah, the way that I think about it is like, if you want to have a strong willpower, a strong mentality, and strong perseverance, like you have to have confidence for that. And you will know if you're lying to yourself. So like step number one is like, be excellent at the things you actually have to be excellent at, you know, that's step number one. And then the mental, you know, the mindset piece, kicks in. So, I mean, that's probably not, you know,
no,
you
that,
hear a lot of these, like, go ahead.
I was going to say, Paul, that actually is, and I know I only have like maybe 20 minutes with you, so it really kind of gets to the core of what one of the reasons I wanted to have you on here. You're just so energetic. You have so much energy and you're so focused and relaxed how you achieved your goals, which I'm so impressed with, because you translate that same kid that you talked about, that same zest and zeal for learning and life, and you've just kind of expanded on that through your life. I mean, you went from going to USC, it's one of the best schools, from getting a GED and not really going to school, and then going to the military, mm-hmm. and not knowing mm-hmm. what you want to do. And then you go get a doctorate. and then now you're out there consulting Fortune 500 companies and building your own businesses, these successful businesses. And it comes down to what I think what you were saying, preparation. But also, like, you were preparing like the physical part of it, but the mental part of it, but in totality it's the preparation that you've done. But it's your mindset. Your mindset is like, hey, how can I prepare and what do I need to do? And I guess that's the question I have for you is, did you use those same skills? And it seems like you are, and I want you to clarify it some for me, is what those skill sets, the skill sets that you brought from the military and then and going to the Green Beret and getting your BA, is that what pushed you also to doing what you do now and being so focused and getting your doctorate?
Yeah. Okay. First, let me dispel something here. When I talk about preparation, I'm really big on identifying, you know, what matters most. Cause I am not the person who, I don't do a lot of things way in advance. I don't do, you know, I am unfortunately good at winging it. And so there are a lot of times where I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, it's 10 minutes before some big meeting or 10 minutes before some presentation. And I'm like, man, why didn't I work on these slides more? Or why didn't I have slides at all? Or why didn't I, you know, so I just, again, I want to dispel the myth that folks who, you know, come from special operations background or who have these, you know, who have terminal academic degrees are just like always, you know, doing their homework, Like, I do not always do my homework. And that's part of the way that I've been able to kind of have multiple lives. You know, at one point I was in the FBI at the same time that I was in a doctoral program, at the same time that I was going out of the country a couple weeks or a couple months out of the year as a Green Beret, at the same time that I was a newlywed, at the same time that I had a fledgling business, you know. And you can't do all of that stuff by being perfect at checking every single box. So I just want to, like, anybody who might be listening to this thinking like, oh, I have to level up my game everywhere. It's like, no, you probably, if you're not getting what you want, you probably have to level your game down in some areas and not invest and rely on your natural skills and your natural instincts to kind of get you through certain moments where you know that you have strengths, you know? But so, you know, for me, it's really about identifying what matters most. And we use this framework. I developed it in my doctoral program, and we've built on it and iterated it in my business over the last couple of years. But I call it the PLE system. And so it's just three elements. You have to do these three things well in order to be successful at anything. And PLE stands for prioritize, leverage, and execute. So prioritizing, I like to explain this through the analogy of mountain climbing. Prioritizing is all about, you know, surveying the landscape, looking at the mountain range, looking at the weather patterns and the clouds, and what are the opportunities and what are the challenges out there, and then picking a mountain and saying, that is the mountain we are going to climb. So that's what prioritizing is all about. And you want to be thinking big and bold and ambitious. And then leveraging, this is where you take that big, bold, ambitious hat off and you put your lazy hat on and you say, okay, that's a tall mountain. How do we make getting to the top of that mountain easy? And so leverage is all about figuring out how you use technology, information, people, and systems, the acronym is TIPS, to build out that base camp at the bottom of the mountain to make climbing that mountain easy. And then execution is all about, it's essentially project management. It's deciding who is going to do what, by when, to what standard. And so you're basically charting that path up the mountain and then actually walking those steps. And so, you know, I think that you can diagnose any personal challenge or ambition, or any professional challenge or ambition at any scale. Again, like a kind of daily task to a long-term corporate strategy to how are you prioritizing, how are you leveraging, and then how are you setting up for successful execution. And we found that folks tend to have mindsets and skill sets that vary across the different elements, prioritizing, leveraging, and executing. And so we built this assessment that you can take. If you go onto our website, apollostrategy.com, you can take this free assessment based on your career level. And so you can say, you know, like, I'm an executive, you go through the assessment takes about 15 minutes, and it'll tell you, you know, are you executives kind of need to live in prioritized land mostly, right? And so this will help you understand, you know, where is your mindset and your skill set and where does it need to be in order to be successful in your role. So you can take it as an executive, a manager, an individual contributor, or a startup executive. And I'm high, high, high prioritized. Like, my mindset is high, high, high prioritized. So I like sitting back and choosing the mountain range, choosing the mountain, predicting the weather, figuring out what's going to matter most. What are the areas on that mountain that are most likely going to be threats for avalanche? So I'm super high prioritized. But some folks are on the other end of the spectrum. There's a guy on my team who we've been best friends since first grade, and he works in my company, who is super, super high execute, and he just wants to be charging up the mountain. So again, that's how I think about, you know, mindset and skill sets aligning, is that you have to prioritize, meaning knowing what must be done. You have to leverage, meaning finding ways to make those things easy. And then you have to execute, which is pulling those levers and doing the stuff.
Apollo, what's the most common problem you see in organizations and like the common barriers why organizations fail?
Why organizations fail? You can categorize any problem in those three ways, right? It's either a problem of prioritizing, meaning they chose the wrong mountain, or they chose no mountain at all. And they just like told everyone like, hey, go take that mountain. And I think everybody has been a part of a team where they have that kind of feeling where they're like, wait, what are we doing here? Why are we here? Which mountain is it? Is it that one? Is it this one? Why is it that one? Right. So I think that a lot of organizations have prioritized problems, but then you can also look at leverage and say, oh my goodness, we're not, you know, organizations have a hard time leveraging technology effectively. And, you know, there's oftentimes a more is better kind of approach when actually more can kind of introduce more confusion. How do you think about information flowing into and out of your organization? You can get hung up there. People, having the right people in the right seats and holding them accountable and giving them the tools to hold others accountable. And then systems and processes. So, I mean, there are lots of ways to kind of fail in the leverage arena. And then execution is, yeah, are the deadlines clear? Is ownership and responsibility of each task clear? Are the standards for those tasks clear? So I think that it also depends on kind of the life cycle of the organization. So a lot of startups fail because they fail in execution. They have some idea, right? Startups are notoriously under leveraged. You don't want to build leverage too early in a startup because you might pivot and change and go want to chase another mountain. So you don't want to build this sprawling base camp at the base of a mountain that you may pivot on, right? And so for startups, they have to be able to prioritize and execute and constantly iterating and refining. So I think startups fail when they either they don't get that prioritize execute cycle right, or they stay stuck in it for too long and they fail to actually start putting leverage in place where they can. With the bigger organizations, you're more likely to run into like prioritizing and leveraging problems. Again, like you have these massive teams that don't understand where they're going or why. And it's just incredibly tough. There's silos, there's technology gaps, there's data challenges. So they're not building the appropriate leverage. So I think it depends on where the organization is, but the cool thing is you can diagnose any one of these challenges by saying we have a prioritized problem, a leverage problem, or an execute problem.
I love this. I love your system. I mean, I've never heard of anyone explain it that way. It's a very, very, it's a very systematic way of looking at an issue and pulling it apart. If somebody wanted to get a hold of you to do some work for their organization, what is the best way to get a hold of you?
Man, LinkedIn is like TikTok for me. I love me some LinkedIn. So if you want to find me on LinkedIn, I'm Apollo Emeka. If you know this guy Fig, you can reach out to Fig and he'll put you in touch with me. But no, really, LinkedIn is my go-to. So I would be thrilled. I mean, the funny thing is, I don't know if you're listening to this and you've never been on a podcast. We also have a podcast. And so it's funny, you think about the people who are making podcasts as just like existing in like podcast land. But we're not in podcast land. Like I'm sitting in my home office. I'm a person. And if I got a message from somebody on LinkedIn that was like, yo, I just heard you on Fig's podcast. That was awesome. Or, hey, that was confusing. Or, hey, whatever. Like I would be thrilled. Okay. I would be thrilled to know that somebody heard this and got something from it. And I would love to engage in a conversation with you. So find me on LinkedIn is probably the best bet. Or like I said, again, apollostrategy.com. That's not plural. That's singular. apollostrategy.com. If you want to go take that assessment, it's completely free. And it gives you about a 40-page customized report based on your responses.
Paul, what's also your podcast? Plug your podcast.
Oh yeah, the podcast is really cool. So it's called The Achievement Index. And what we do is we have notable leaders take the Achievement Index, take this assessment, and then we invite them onto the show to talk about talk about their accomplishments through this lens. So it might be like, hey, how did you accomplish these big things? You have like no execute, or It looks like, you know, you are your score shows that you have a high leverage mindset. How's that showing up for you? So super cool. And I would love for you to check that out. It's called the Achievement Index.
And I also note that you have a very good presence on YouTube as well. And you have a wonderful...
On YouTube?
You actually have a wonderful video on imposter syndrome. So if anybody has a chance to go on YouTube check that out. And yeah. this is my final question I want to ask you now, because I want to be respectful of your time.
I appreciate it.
At the end of your life, what do you want to be remembered for? When you're no longer on this earth anymore, when people think of you, what do you want to be remembered for?
Man, that's a that's an important question. I think that everybody should be asked right now. You know, you and I have talked about it. It's just such a divisive. I feel like as human beings, we're seeing the humanity in each other less and less and less. And that's why, again, I love the focus of your doctoral work of focusing on empathy. And I think that, you know, for whatever problems that we have in the world, people are the answer. People are the solution. And we've got to be able to see the humanity in one another. So I guess at the end of my life, I would hope that people saw me as someone who brought folks together and who helped, who helped expose the humanity of people from all different backgrounds and beliefs.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for being here. You have such an amazing story. I could go on for like 3 or 4 hours with you.
Well, you can tell I can too. I know how to talk. Okay. So I'm sorry. And you're welcome.
You did such a fantastic job. I'm so inspired by you, because I think a lot of times people feel as though that you have to follow traditional paths to success, and you've achieved so much, and it's a very untraditional way how you did it. And it's just a great, great story, and you're so successful and you have a wonderful family. Thank you so much. I thank you, fellow Trojan, for being on here, and fight on. And until next time, everyone, to our next great guest, like Apollo, take care and keep learning. Bye-bye.